Please call the case.
Calling case number SCWC30700, Patrickson v. Dole. Arguing for the petitioner, Sean M. Lyons. Arguing for the respondent, Dole Pineapple Company, Andrea E. Newman. Also arguing for the respondent, Dow Chemical Company, Michael L. Brown.
Good morning, counsel. Are you all ready to proceed today?
Yes,
sir. All right, so Mr. Lyons, you've reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal. We'll give you a warning with 10 minutes to go. My understanding, Ms. Newman, is you have 14 minutes of the 30 minutes allotted to the respondents, and we'll give you a warning at that point. And then, Mr. Brem, you'll have the remaining 16 minutes, and we'll give you a warning with 5 minutes to go. Please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. We are very appreciative of the court granting writ for this we consider a very important case, very important matters for the court. To go right to what I believe will inevitably be the focus of the court, there is simply no clear objective evidence, either in the record on appeal or in the briefs submitted to the Court of Appeals, the Intermediate Court of Appeals, that a class action was pending in federal court or that a class action certification was ever denied. That would be under either Texas state rules or under federal rules. There was simply a form of convenience dismissal with all pending motions.
Well, the order did reference a motion for class certification that was pending, right? But let me ask you this. In this case, Patrickson case, the motion for class, you have raised this as concerns for the putative class members.
Yes.
But the motion for class certification in this case was actually already denied in 2008. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So there is no, at this point, there's no putative class that we're dealing with in this case.
At this point.
And you never appealed that portion. You never appealed the denial of the Rule 23 motion.
That's correct.
Okay. So we're actually dealing with these six named plaintiffs now. Is that correct?
That is correct.
All right. These six named plaintiffs were in the Abarca case. Correct?
They were, yes, they were.
Were they also in the Carcamo case?
Yes,
As putative class members, but not as named plaintiffs.
Right.
So in terms of as of named plaintiffs, it was only in the Abarca case, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, and this case, the Patrickson case.
Yes. Right.
Thank you.
So the resolution of this case will only affect those six named plaintiffs?
Well, there is a filing in Delaware that may be affected by what happens here to the extent that what happens here is persuasive. But specifically, yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
Can you elaborate about the first part of your answer?
Well, there is, to the extent that the other litigation that our firm is involved in, plaintiffs that we're representing in Delaware and Louisiana have been cited as persuasive authority by the respondents here. There may be some citations to what happens here in what we have pending in Delaware.
I thought the Delaware case was okay. What's the status of the Delaware case?
We have plaintiffs in Delaware that are pending argument court. It's on appeal to the Superior Court of Delaware. But I guess.
Okay, so there's a state court case and a federal court case in Delaware? What's going on in Delaware?
Your Honor, I apologize. I'm not extremely familiar with it. I wanted to make sure I was answering fully Your Honor's question as to the potential effects of what happens here. Direct answer is, we're only here about the six plaintiffs.
Okay, all right.
Could you explain while you're on that how you would interpret the effect of the dismissal in 1995 of the claim?
Yes. The dismissal in 1995 was a form of convenience dismissal, and there were conditions applied in July that if those conditions were met in October, it would be a form of convenience dismissal. There was no direct treatment at all of any motion for certification as part of that.
Didn't the court specifically state it was in order for discovery to take place? That's why the effectiveness of the order was due?
That's not my understanding of the order. But it's a long order, and Your Honor could be correct. But my understanding of the order was that certain very number of conditions must be met, conditions that are more subject for nonconvenience, and that if those conditions can be met within the next 3 months, 90 days, then the dismissal would take effect in October, in late October.
I thought the
I think what the important purposes are for argument here today is that all of the three cases, especially that the court has asked us to review, and every other case that is on the subject of what ends told, all have a bright line rule that a denial of class certification is what ends the tolling period. And that form of inconvenience dismissal was not a bright line, clear indication.
Well, in actuality, the case was reinstated based on the return jurisdiction provision, correct?
It was, I'm not sure what you mean by reinstated.
Well, there was a return jurisdiction provision that said that if the highest court of any state dismisses, you know, we're dismissing this case for FNC, but if a foreign, the highest court of any foreign country says there's no jurisdiction, then you can return and it'll be as if this case was never dismissed. And in fact, that happened in Costa Rica. There was a motion to reinstate. The case was reinstated and remanded to the Texas court, correct?
That's correct, yes.
This case was actually never really dismissed.
That's correct.
In fact, the Texas state court had dealt with a motion for class certification in Carcamo, correct?
Right. That's right.
There
was a clear denial of class certification in Carcamo.
Right.
Occurred in 2010.
Right.
That was the clear ending of the tolling.
Right. So this case has actually always been pending.
That's correct.
Wasn't there a requirement on that return jurisdiction provision in the order that said, well, I think it's by law that if these cases are reinstated, nobody loses any of their rights? Isn't that one of the conditions? In other words, if it's reinstated, everybody kind of goes back to their rights.
That's correct.
I thought there was a judgment of some kind filed in the Texas action and later in October. Was there not some document filed that confirmed the dismissal or not?
I'm not familiar with that.
Okay. October 27, 1995, the district court in Texas did file a judgment after the 3 months had elapsed that they had allowed for discovery.
Well, that judgment, however, is not a determination of class certification. And I guess what I want to keep coming home to, and I apologize if I get repetitive, is that what the bright line rule is that has been created so far to notify putative plaintiffs in a class action of the end of the tolling would be a denial of class certification. Now, there's a difference between this.
We're not worried about notification of putative class members, though, right now. So how does that affect our real-life six remaining plaintiffs in this case?
Well, it means the statute of limitations was not expired when we filed this case, which I think is one of the issues that we're here on appeal over.
That's actually the only issue here, right?
Well, then that's the effect. That if the tolling continued up through 2010, then when we filed this case in 1993, clearly there was still within the statute of limitations.
So your position is that after the 1995 dismissal, your clients, putative class members, were being reasonable to rely upon the class to protect their interests?
Yes, that's very well put. That is using the analysis that supports the bright line rule, which is that there must be a denial of class certification, that we still objectively relied upon the polling numbers.
And why then do you think your client's reliance was reasonable?
Because our clients understood that there was still a live issue in Texas under the Carcamo case. There was never a denial of class certification. Therefore, their rights were still being preserved because of the tolling of that occurs because there was no denial of the class certification.
Until 2010.
Yes, and the public policy behind that is very previous stated Crown Court levy and the Crown Court concealed cases that have been cited in the briefing, that were individuals not able to rely upon such a bright line rule administratively, it could be a nightmare. Plaintiffs, lawyers, plaintiffs may want to preserve, just to be sure, preserve their own individual causes of action, that there was just some subtle suggestion that the rights were no longer being preserved by some class motion for class certification that was still on file and had not yet been denied. Individuals might start filing cases willy-nilly all over the place. Now, there were some filings.
I wonder what kind of notice there is, even assuming, you know, we make this presumption of notice, but we have this order that's, you know, something like 41 pages or something like that, and in it, it says the things can occur discovery, and then the order takes effect in 90 days, and it can be reinstated at any time if some other country doesn't accept the case. I mean, that's pretty slim notice, it would seem to me.
Well, that's certainly our argument. All that would have to be done to tidy up the affairs if the defendants wanted to do so was to clearly move from class certification as part of the process and say, all right, well, as part of this, can we also have a denial of class certifications?
So were there not a pending motion for class certification in the case?
There's no, honestly, it's hard to tell.
I'm sorry?
Honestly, it's very hard to tell from the record.
There was. There was a motion for class certification pending in that case.
As to whether or not it was ruled upon, it's even harder to tell.
Well,
I thought it said all pending motions in those cases not otherwise expressly addressed in this memorandum and order are denied as moot. Why is that not clear notice that if you have a pending motion for class certification, it has been denied as of the date of the order?
It's, first of all, the Texas courts, and some evidence that it wasn't clear notice would be that the Texas courts in 2010 felt it necessary to go in and deny class certification in the state court, which shows that and counsel present here today was in that motion, that denial of certification. No one argued that was moot or that it was unnecessary because it's already been denied in the federal court. So obviously the Texas courts came to the conclusion that there had not yet been a denial of certification in 2010, as of 2010. So obviously we reasonably relied upon a similar understanding. Not to say that maybe someone on the record it should have been clear to someone sophisticated to see that it's worthy of argument. But that is not in keeping with the necessary bright line rule that requires a straight up denial of certification. In fact, the two of the three cases you had that we reviewed specifically to request of the court state not only do you have to have a clear denial of certification, class certification, but you have to have the reasons. Only Bridges says a simple denial of class certification is sufficient to end the tolling.
But one of your arguments below was that the case was actually continued to be pending, right? And if that is the situation, we don't really have to deal with the July 95 order. If the case was still pending, I mean, it was based on the return jurisdiction provision, and it was returned, and the case continued, then what is the effect of a July 95 order?
You know, I think that's probably maybe a better order of business to go about. I think the court's, your suggestion, Your Honor, is well taken.
Did you file a complaint there in 97?
We did. And, you know, all of the law, I mean, if you look at the dates of the laws the rulings that we're talking about, they explain why what we did, in excess of caution, is one thing. But had we filed this complaint in 2012, since the class certification was not denied until 2010, we would still be correct.
Mr. Lyons, I noted the light went out. I don't think we're at the 20-minute point yet. That was just a mistake. In case you were still, you don't worry that you thought time was flying, but not that fast. So carry on. You're only about 15 minutes in by my count, 14 minutes.
If I may move along a little bit, we have the issue of the opt-out, the argument that the putative plaintiffs opted out by filing the FARCA claim, which was never served. So you know, it's a long story, and I think it's covered somewhat in the briefing as to why that was done. But the long and short of it is, and I think what's important here, and I hope this court doesn't intend to belabor this, but it takes a lot to opt out of a class action. And there's really no relevant precedent to say, or certainly no controlling precedent to say, that filing a lawsuit, never serving you, could possibly opt out class members from a future class. And I think the most important thing is to consider the public policy, behind class actions and management of litigation that is the benefits to the courts, to everybody, not just the plaintiffs, by having class action filed and people relying upon them being members of those class, or that putative class, until something very positive, some form is filled out, something that shows a clear reliance to take yourself out of that future class in order to opt out. That's what is required in every class action, certainly once certified. And to say that we've opted out by filing a BARCA, it's a gotcha mechanism. And we know there's a lot of dirty words for that kind of gotcha mechanism, but the real effect of that kind of gotcha law is that it just creates more paranoia among the people who might represent, or the class members, the putative class members, or creates more paranoia among the class members themselves. And the result of that kind of worry is, the results of that is that more people file more lawsuits on behalf of individuals applying for courts. And that flies in the face of what class action is supposed to try to resolve, the economic dispensation of justice for those who, frankly, in the case of most class actions, are fairly powerless, facing very, very powerful defendants.
Now, so these six plaintiffs were also named plaintiffs in the Abarca case, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, and are they currently plaintiffs in any other pending cases, for example, in the Texas case, or is this the only forum remaining for them?
May I turn around and look at my co-counsel?
Yes.
They are filed in Delaware. No, I thought that to be the case. I wanted to make sure before I listened to that.
So what's the status of Delaware? Do you know? I'm sure defense counsel knows.
It's been an appeal, is my understanding. Appeal.
Thank you. What about cross-jurisdictional tolling? What's the defendants say that the overwhelming majority of jurisdictions reject it. Do you agree with that characterization, and what do you think the appropriate rules should be here in Hawaii?
I would not say the overwhelming majority of districts that have faced the question have rejected it, but I probably would agree that if you were just to count the courts, a majority of districts that have faced the question have rejected cross-jurisdictional tolling. Now, the term is a bit of an interesting one. Tolling should be cross-jurisdictional as a default. So I would argue that anyone who hasn't directly faced this question allows cross-jurisdictional tolling. It's a new animal to sort of say, hey, you can't bring this across state lines. And to answer your last question, in Hawaii, I think the clear benefit to Hawaii would be from allowing cross-jurisdictional tolling. There is.
Otherwise, every potential class action would have to be filed here.
That's correct. You have to cross the courts from the concern of the potential members of the class action and say, well, as soon as the statute of limitations is coming up, I'm either going to have to fly to Delaware to pursue my $150 claim of the bank or my $350 claim against the predatory lender or whatever it is in the class action, or I've got to file my lawsuit here now before the statute of limitations up if I ever want to keep my claim alive in Hawaii. And it's an unfair situation to put plaintiffs in here in Hawaii, because they should be able to join ranks with the National Council in a class action, stay involved in a class action. Now, if you put the cross-jurisdictional question right next to their other argument, which is sort of pinching from the other side, this opt-out provision, if you take both of their arguments together, what you have is an absurd result of saying, once you file to preserve your claim at the statute of limitations here in Hawaii, you've opted out of the class action. And how unfair is that?
It seems like several of the places where it's been rejected, they've been federal courts interpreting what they thought would be state law.
That's correct. And the places that say that there was no cross-jurisdictional tolling are states that seem to be concerned that they would be inundated with people filing claims in their state, that Tennessee's example of that. Is that really a concern here? Why? Are people who otherwise would have a claim in Minnesota or North Carolina going to be rushing to file their claims across the ocean in Hawaii, where it's more expensive and you have to take a separate bar in order to be found licensed here or to be able to practice here? Is it really a concern that you have here in Hawaii? In other words, when you weigh out the costs and benefits of Hawaii, the costs are high and the benefits are low. And so respectfully, we argue that cross-jurisdictional tolling should be allowed in Hawaii.
Thank you.
With that, I'll reserve the remainder of our time unless there's any questions right now.
None at this time, so. We'll hear from Ms. Newman at this point.
May it please the court, Andrea Newman on behalf of Dole Food and the Dole-related defendants. Thank your honors for your time this morning. Class action tolling lengthens statutes of limitations that the legislature has determined strike the right balance between claim determination and a fair opportunity to defend. Cross-jurisdictional class action tolling leaves the extent to which those statutes will be lengthened to the courts and legislatures of other states. That is why at least half a dozen state Supreme Courts have rejected cross-jurisdictional tolling, or I should say that is one of the reasons they have rejected it.
So how would you respond to plaintiff's counsel's argument that then in those states plaintiffs would have to file complaints, right? And if for some reason they dismissed those complaints, they would be deemed to have opted out?
Well, I would say two things to that, Your Honor. The first one is that if you're a putative plaintiff in a class action pending in a certain state, you can certainly file your individual claim there if class is denied. You can intervene in the ongoing action and proceed. So it's not a matter of not being able to pursue your individual claim, because you could obviously pursue it where the class action was filed. If you have a class action, as we do here, that was filed in Texas, and for some reason, if you're going to pursue an individual claim rather than being in Texas, you want to be in Hawaii, if you see that your statute of limitations is running, you would need to file a protective action in Hawaii to maintain your individual claim here. But as the Louisiana Supreme Court said in Quinn and the Supreme Court said in Portwood, Illinois Supreme Court said in Portwood, those are going to be very few cases. They're easy to stay because the plaintiff can explain why they need to file, but why also they want their case stayed. And both the plaintiff and defendants in the class action can be encouraged to resolve the class tolling issue promptly. In fact, one of the reasons that American Pipe Court was comfortable with class action tolling as a concept was because it viewed that under Rule 23, class action issues would be addressed expeditiously, since the rule requires that they be addressed as soon as practical by the courts at the district court level.
So if in the Carcamo case, there was a pending motion for class action, correct?
Yes.
It had been filed, and your position is that as of the July 95 order, it was denied as moot, correct?
Correct.
And that triggered the, that was the end of tolling, right? But, well, assuming cross-jurisdictional tolling is recognized. But so what if that motion had been actually been ruled on and the Texas District Court had granted the motion for class certification and then granted the motion to dismiss for form nonconvenience, and then with the return jurisdiction provision, and the case came back, and then there was, you know, what happened here happened. Patrickson, the United States Supreme Court says no jurisdiction under FSIA. What would be your position as to that motion for class certification having been granted? Would that be effective and binding on the Texas court? What effect would that motion have had, that order have had?
Well, in the context of these six plaintiffs that are before your honors, that's a very interesting question, because the reason the plaintiffs filed in Florida in June, the Abarca case, was to ensure that they would not be subject to any subsequent rulings coming out of Texas. They weren't named plaintiffs in Texas, and when they saw that the Texas court might issue injunctions they didn't like, might issue a form nonconvenience order they didn't like, they filed in Florida so they wouldn't be subject to those orders. Then, on July 11th, when the court did deny class certification as moot, the next day, they dismissed the Florida action, because at that moment in time, it was clear that the only plaintiffs that were going to remain subject to the Texas action were the named plaintiffs. Now, there was a lot of them, 14,000, but these six weren't among them. And then, as the court has indicated in earlier questioning, for the next 90 days, discovery took place, stipulations were entered into between the defendants and the named plaintiffs.
I'm aware of the procedural background, so please just respond to the question. Do you think that that order granting class certification would have been effective despite the lack of subject matter jurisdiction?
What Judge Lake determined, and I believe he's correct on this in terms of the Supreme Court authority he cited, was that he did not lose subject matter jurisdiction retrospectively. I think if...
But wasn't that specific holding overruled by... there's a Texas... There's a ruling in this... It's a memorandum opinion in Ray Standard Food, and they said that he had no jurisdiction at all and his order was void.
The Texas Appellate Court disagreed with Judge Lake, but I don't believe they had any jurisdiction to overrule him, per se. They disagreed with him when he said he didn't leave jurisdiction. I think the Supreme Court authority Judge Lake cited is actually a posit and shows that he's correct. But in terms of these six plaintiffs, if they were no longer part of the Carcamo putative class because they were actively pursuing the Florida claims. As to putative plaintiffs who had not otherwise actively pursued claims, if the class motion had been granted and then the FNC dismissal entered, one would assume, although this is a difficult hypothetical, that the class members would have had to comply with the terms of the FNC order, which is a very disjointed analysis. And I think one of the reasons that Judge Lake wanted to resolve all the other motions that were on the docket when he knew he was going to grant an FNC order is precisely because that type of situation creates a lot of issues that would be difficult to resolve. He discusses, as I believe you noted, that class action motions were pending at page 1368 of his order. And he makes clear that in the briefing on FNC, the plaintiffs and defendants are arguing about does the fact that class motions are pending make it less likely or more likely that I should grant FNC, or less fair or more fair? And then when he gets to the end, he says, okay, everything other than the FNC is denied as moot. It's crystal clear from both the two dockets in Carcamo and Delgado and the opinion itself, even if you didn't have access to the dockets, that he was denying the motion for class certification. And I actually think it was very important that he did that at that juncture, because subsequent to that, the defendants had to enter into stipulations about waiving the right to make statute of limitations claims and other issues as to the named plaintiffs. These would not have been stipulations that would have been fair or appropriate if they applied to an unnamed putative class. They just wouldn't have. So it was important that the class nature of the proceeding ended in July, and it did, in fact, end in July. And there was no ambiguity, as to that. In addition to which, the plaintiffs here before your honors are represented by counsel who was counsel for other plaintiffs in Carcamo. He was actively participating in that case.
Okay. What about this return jurisdiction provision and the fact that the case was actually reinstated and remanded? This case was actually continued in effect, didn't it? I mean, it was reinstated.
It did not continue, Your Honor. It was final judgment was entered in 1995, and that final judgment was appealed and dealt with by the Fifth Circuit, and cert was denied by the U.S. Supreme Court.
And what's the authority of a final judgment by a court that has no subject matter jurisdiction?
Well, I believe that the court had jurisdiction at the time he entered final judgment. And so that final judgment still exists and is binding.
Well, then the return jurisdiction provision was actually exercised, right? The case, the same case, it came back as the same case, correct?
Part of the case came back. Only Costa Rican plaintiffs came back and took the position that they had fulfilled the terms of the return jurisdiction clause. So the case is not pending. It's over between 1995 and 2006. That's why when those plaintiffs came back, they had to make a motion to reinstate the case.
And that motion was granted.
And that motion was granted.
And that case that had been dismissed or dormant or whatever you call it for 11 years was reinstated. It was the same case that was reopened.
I believe it was slightly narrow in scope, but it was in part the same case.
All right. Yeah. So are these?
But it wasn't pending in the interim.
Are these plaintiffs Costa Rican in our Patrickson case?
Some of them are and some of them are not. Of the six, I think they're also.
Is that what the order said, that it was, that it would only be reinstated as to the people from that country?
My understanding, Your Honor, is that it was only Costa Rican plaintiffs who went to Costa Rica, attempted to bring their claims there, got a ruling from the Costa Rican court that it would not exercise jurisdiction. So they were the ones that came back.
But it didn't. But when it was reopened, it wasn't just as to the Costa Ricans, right? It was the same case that was reopened with the pending. Was it only reopened as to the six to the Costa Rican plaintiffs that filed the motion?
My understanding is that the case was reinstated on the motion of Costa Rican plaintiffs who had met the terms of the.
But the case was reinstated, and when it was remanded to Texas, it was everybody, correct?
That's not clear to me, Your Honor. I thought it was more focused.
Well,
on
then
the Costa Rican
why
plaintiffs.
Weren't there were Delgado plaintiffs that settled in Texas, and then there was a motion for class certification in Carcamo, correct? That was denied?
Yes, in 2010.
And they weren't all Costa Ricans, right?
There was only two interveners that moved for class certification in Carcamo in 1996, and I would have to defer to Mr. Brim on their nationality.
Okay.
Ms. Newman, could you just clarify? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Go ahead.
Justice
Akiyama. Please, Justice, go ahead.
I just wanted to be clear then about your position as to why it wouldn't have been reasonable for the plaintiffs in this case to rely upon this return jurisdiction aspect of the order in 1995, the order of dismissal. Why wouldn't that have been reasonable to rely upon in terms of protecting the class interest?
Because there was no putative class that was governed by the return jurisdiction clause. The return jurisdiction clause, by its terms, only applied to the named plaintiff. The putative class ended in July of 1995. So when the court said you can come back and move for reinstatement if you meet the terms of this return jurisdiction clause, the you is the 14,000 named plaintiffs in Carcamo, which does not include the six plaintiffs we have here in Patrickson.
So that's your distinction, because these plaintiffs weren't plaintiffs in Carcamo.
Correct. I also think it's unreasonable to rely on the continuation of a class action once the motion for class certification has been denied, as it was here. And as to these six plaintiffs in particular, they disassociated themselves from the Texas class. They filed in Florida in June of 95, and then it was only after the class motion, cert motions had been denied as moot, that they dismissed that action.
When was it denied as moot, in your opinion?
July 11, 1995.
Even though the court specifically says, in addition to the defendant's motion for form nonconvenience, a number of other motions are pending. And then the court says, because Delgado, Jorge Carcamo, Valdez, and Isaiah Carcamo may be dismissed in 90 days, all pending motions in those cases not otherwise expressly addressed in this memorandum order are denied as moot. May be dismissed in 90 days. So the order dismissing as moot occurs even before the dismissal? Is that the argument?
Yes, Your Honor. The docket entry shows that the order dismissing them as moot was entered, has the phrase entered, on that day. In addition, what Judge Lake was saying...
But when it's entered, is this different than when it's effective? Aren't they two different things?
Those are two different things, Your Honor. I agree. But what Judge Lake made clear was that the other motions were denied as of that day, and that the FNC order was conditional. I don't believe that Judge Lake intended, or that the record reflects, that the other motions were not conditional.
Ms. Newman, what is your response to Mr. Lyons' argument that the court didn't mean to deny the class certification because the Texas state court later entered an order denying?
Well, the Texas state court denied a different motion for class certification. There was no motion pending when the case was reinstated. So the interveners brought a new motion for class certification, and the court denied that new motion, which also doesn't address any defect in the class. It's just a one-line order that says class denied. I think it's important, if the court is going to consider adopting cross-jurisdictional tolling, to have a very clear rule about when that tolling ends. And in Armstrong and other cases, that rule is on the first rule, on the first denial of class certification.
If we rule that this case, tolling didn't end till sometime in 2010, when there was a clear denial of class certification in Carcamo, we don't really have to deal with it. If we rule that the case was actually still, was reinstated, basically nunk-pro-tunk, to the original dismissal, because that's what the federal court order says. The return jurisdiction says the plaintiff may return to this court, and upon proper motion, the court will resume jurisdiction over the action as if the case had never been dismissed for FNC, case had never been dismissed. So the case was reinstated as if the case had never been dismissed as of October 27, 1995. So when this case was filed in 1997, although albeit retroactively, it's as if this case had never been dismissed.
Well, I think the case was dismissed, and the statute had run before this case was filed.
But wasn't your point that these six plaintiffs aren't among the 14,000 who could come back?
Correct, Your Honor.
So as to these six plaintiffs, it's not as if the case was not would never be and could not be resumed as if it had ever stopped. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Excuse me.
And I also just wanted to answer the court's question as to the status of Delaware. These plaintiffs, the six plaintiffs here, after they lost in the trial court, filed a new action in Delaware. In the Delaware court, they made the argument that they're making here, which is that the statute of limitations continued until 2010. The Delaware Federal District Court rejected that argument. It found that class tolling ended in July of 1995. and that the case they filed in Delaware.
What was the basis of federal court jurisdiction in that case? The Class Action Fairness Act?
They filed in federal court.
They filed in federal court?
Yes, Your Honor. So the six Patterson plaintiffs have already had this issue resolved against them on the merits in federal court in Delaware.
And they appealed that?
They intend to appeal it, is my understanding, but it's already been decided against them there, and so we think the court should defer to that ruling here, and if they're successful in convincing the Third Circuit that that district court was wrong, then that's fine, but I don't think they should have another bite at the apple here.
Is that a part of the record?
Yes. The May 2014 decision that you're referring
yes,
to?
Yes, Your Honor. We referenced it in our supplemental briefing.
Okay, maybe we should let Mr. Brem get his shot now. Thank you very much, Ms. Newman. Appreciate it.
May it please the court, my name is Mike Brem. I'm from Houston, Texas. Along with Mr. Young and Mr. Goto, I represent the Dow Chemical Company in this litigation. Although today, like Ms. Newman, I'm speaking on behalf of all other defendants. Given the questions that have been posed to Mr. Lyons and Ms. Newman, as Mr. Lyons alluded to, I should say one more thing by way of introduction. I was Dow Chemical's lawyer in every single one of these cases that we are discussing today. I was Dow Chemical's lawyer in Delgado. I was Dow Chemical's lawyer in Cartamo. I was Dow Chemical's lawyer in Abarca. I was Dow Chemical's lawyer here, and more cases than I can count anymore. We are talking about a number of things, and I would like to start with something that Justice McKenna has repeatedly brought up. Justice McKenna, I would say to you that I could not disagree with your characterization about this case being ongoing more strongly. This case had a final judgment entered on October the 27th, 1995. That final judgment was affirmed by the United States Supreme Court in 2000. Cert was denied in that case in 2001. This was as dismissed a case could possibly be. The fact that it rose like the phoenix from the ashes doesn't change the fact that
How could it be reinstated then?
It was reinstated pursuant to Fifth Circuit authority, Your Honor.
The return jurisdiction requirement.
The return jurisdiction clause, that's exactly right. But tolling nonetheless stopped when it stopped. It may have restarted. But there was a gap between 1995 and the reinstatement of this case, and I want to go back to that, in 2006 in Texas. Another thing that Your Honor was asking about.
Is the order reinstating a part of the record?
I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor, because it was something the plaintiffs have been urging. I have not looked for it. Let me say one more thing. There were 14,000 plaintiffs in the consolidated Delgado Carcamo action. The class definition expressly excluded them from the putative class. One more thing about that. Only the Costa Ricans ever sought to return pursuant to the return jurisdiction clause. The cases that were reinstated in part were Delgado and in part Carcamo. And only the Costa Ricans, none of the Guatemalans, none of the Panamanians, none of the Hondurans, none of the St. Lucians, none of the Dominicans, none of the St. Vincents, or I don't exactly know what they would be, citizens of St. Vincent, none of the citizens of Burkina Faso, and none of the citizens of the Philippines. Thousands upon thousands of plaintiffs were not reinstated. Only Costa Rican plaintiffs were reinstated. One more thing.
Then the motion for class certification in Carcamo in Texas, who did that deal with?
A class. 25 countries, Your Honor. 25.
Oh, countries. So the motion did deal with people from all these other countries.
All of those countries.
It was denied, but what was the basis of the Texas court's denial?
The basis of the Texas court's denial, and this answers a question that Justice Pollack had, there was no question in anybody's mind in that courtroom, in that case, including me or Mr. Hindler, that that case was going to be dismissed for forum nonconvenience. That's what Judge Lake had done.
But it was not on the basis that the case had only been reinstated as to the Costa Ricans.
I'm back in 1995. You are up in 2009 now, Your Honor. We're in different time frames. It is our contention that the class certification in Delgado, at the latest, ended on July the 11th, 1995, when Judge Lake issued his memorandum and order that is found at 890 F sub 1324. And in answer to Justice Pollack's question, what he said there was, because these cases may be dismissed, all pending motions are denied. He did not say, might be denied, will be denied, conditionally will be denied in October. He said, are denied. And the reason he did that is he was complying with Fifth Circuit precedent, which required defendants to enter into certain stipulations and agreements, which they did. Those agreements were that we would submit to the jurisdiction of the foreign court, that we would satisfy any judgment there, and we would waive certain periods of limitations when these plaintiffs refiled in those foreign courts. The only reason he put 90 days out there was he crafted his own remedy in favor of the plaintiffs, in that the defendants were also required to submit to discovery. All of this is on the next to last page of the Delgado opinion. And all of that happened as well. When you review the docket sheet of Delgado, all of these things transpired.
So why did the order say May?
It was either that, think of this alternative, Your Honor. It was either that or say, I'm dismissing the case for form nonconvenience today.
Why not say will be dismissed? Why not say will be dismissed?
He's because it was conditional. We had to do what he outlined on the next to last page of Delgado.
But if you had to do what was conditioned, that means that the dismissal for mootness didn't occur until you did those things.
The dismissal did not occur. The motions, all pending motions, were denied on July the 11th.
But it's likewise, until and unless you did those things, that order denying it was conditional.
The order, the portion of the order dismissing the case for forum nonconvenience was conditional. But Judge Lake's language says exactly what it says. It says all pending motions are denied, present tense.
And the case was, however, despite the final judgment, despite the denial of cert, was reinstated.
Yes, Your Honor. And the most reasonable interpretation of that, assuming that this court is going to adopt class action, cross-jurisdictional class action tolling, is that tolling ended.
When was it reinstated?
It was 2006, I believe, Your Honor. The most reasonable interpretation of that circumstance is that tolling ended in the first instance in July of 1995, July the 11th, 1995. Tolling then restarted for any new plaintiffs who might be saved by class action tolling when the class allegations were reasserted in Carcamo, in Texas state court, in the middle of the last decade. So there was a lapse, but the most reasonable interpretation there is that class action tolling ended. It may have restarted, no different than if a trial court denied on the merits class certification. We would all agree that tolling would end at that point, but then subject to a motion to reconsider several months later, decided, okay, I will rehear this again. But tolling certainly ended the first time around, only to restart at some later point. So here, what we have is a situation where...
When was the motion filed to reinstate? I thought it was filed in 1996, soon after the Costa Rican dismissal.
The motion was filed soon after, but it was denied without prejudice, Your Honor.
Because
the case was on appeal.
That case was on appeal.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right.
The Delgado case was on appeal. It was argued in March of 1997 before the Fifth Circuit. The Fifth Circuit did not decide it until 2000. So Judge Lake denied the motion to reinstate without prejudice of it being reheard. It was not reheard until the middle of the last decade in a Texas state court. What happened in the meantime, Your Honor, was the Patrickson, this case, was decided by the United States Supreme Court. The plaintiffs in Delgado went back to Judge Lake and said, you should vacate your forum nonconvenience dismissal. Judge Lake said, I had jurisdiction at the time. It was affirmed by the this circuit, cert was denied. Principles of finality, citing the United States Supreme Court decisions, say my decision stands. He declined to vacate the form non-convenience dismissal. That was never challenged on appeal. Then, within a very short time, 6 weeks or so, the plaintiffs came back to him and said, okay, if you won't vacate your form non-convenience dismissal, we Costa Ricans have had, the Costa Rican subset of Delgado have had a motion to reinstate pending for some time. You denied it only without prejudice. We say you can't hear that motion, Judge Lake, because Patrickson makes clear you don't have jurisdiction. Judge Lake agreed with that, remanded the case to the Texas State Court, where both, with the two different counties, Carcamo to one county and Delgado to another, where both courts reinstated the case. Now, back to an issue that Justice Pollack raised.
How is a putative class member, the regular person, supposed to figure all this out? How are they on notice? How are they supposed to figure this out?
Your Honor, that's it. That is part of the argument that I have in my outline that I haven't discussed. When we talk about class action tolling, we're indulging a fiction. There are 320 Americans, 320 people living in the United States. There are slightly more than a million lawyers. If you took the million lawyers off the top of that, the number of lay people who could discuss and understand class action tolling of limitations numbers surely in the dozens out of 320 million people. Indeed, of the 1.3 million lawyers that are in the United States, I dare say a quarter of those know anything about class action tolling. But we don't have to understand that here, Your Honor. Mr. Hindler, one of the lawyers in this case, was also a lawyer in Delgado and Carcamo. He was there right with me through this long journey. So we
can,
know.
Can I interrupt you just for a moment about your journey? Because I was wondering, at that point in the journey where there was discussions about the 95 dismissal with the provision for a reinstatement at a later time, did the attorneys at that time have any discussion about the effects of the order on tolling?
On tolling?
Yes.
No, Your Honor. I see my time's up.
Well, I'll allow you to answer the question, and then I'll give you just a brief time to wrap up at that point.
No, Your Honor. There was no discussion about class action tolling at that point. In fact, in the original complaint here in this case, you will not find class action tolling raised at all.
Thank you.
We urge that the court affirm.
Thank you. Mr. Lyons.
Thank you. It seems everyone agrees that a bright line rule should be in place to let class action, putative class action members and their attorneys know that tolling has come to an end. The bright line would require that the pending motion for certification, for class certification, be clearly before the court. That there be a clear denial of class certification, and in this case, that it be effective on a particular date. None of those are present here today. Now, I know that we've had some discussion about what was pending before this court, but was it under Rule 42, the state rules in Texas, or was it under Rule 23? I mean, will this court be able to explain exactly what pending motion for class certification was before it? Judge Lake, so that when we have this ambiguous all pending motions being denied, is it really clear to everyone, including Mr. Hendler, and certainly to the actual putative class members, that a class certification has been denied? Was it even clear to the Texas court, which later felt the need to deny class certification on these very cases? Without that bright line being met, which we all agree must be met, then tolling continued. The last point is, when was it effective? If this order was set in the order itself, entered in July, but set to take effect, not until 90 days later, isn't that the earliest point that class certification could potentially be denied?
Do you think it really was October 27th when the final judgment was ordered then? Is that what you're arguing?
Yes, but we are, just to be clear, we are arguing that there is nothing in that order that makes it clear that class certification is denied.
But the judgment kind of seals it, though.
That's it doesn't seal that a class certification has been denied.
Are you saying it still hasn't been denied?
No, that the class certification is still a matter that hasn't been ruled upon.
I thought it said all other motions are denied. All pending motions in these cases not otherwise expressly addressed or denied is moot. So accepting your argument that there's some ambiguity about that up until the time of the judgment, are you saying that even the judgment, once there's judgment, it's still somehow ambiguous?
Our argument is that, yes, it's still an ambiguous statement. Because that it was a pending motion is still something that was not clear. Was there a motion by plaintiffs for class certification under Federal Rule 23 at that point? I don't think that the record bears that out. Now, Mr. Brown has argued, well, then, and I completely appreciate Judge McKenna's very, very astute observation that the reinstatement that occurred in 2010 is effectively a nunk-pro-tunk of this October judgment or this order in July of 19.
Is that order in the record?
The order from 1995?
The order reinstating the case.
I do not know. But the effectiveness of it, I would agree with the suggestion by Justice McKenna that it effectively nullifies this order from July of 1995, which means that tolling would be continuous, nonstop up to that point if that order from 1995 is considered to be non-pro-tunk effectively, or that it was it has basically lost its effectiveness. But Mr. Brehm argues, well, then there would be a gap. That's a clever idea.
Does Costa, do these other countries allow class actions?
That I know of, Your Honor, no. And I think you jumped right to where I was headed, which is, what is the reason that we're back here with reinstatement? The reason is because form of nonconvenience was go find another forum. And when that's not found, and we can convince the courts here that's not found, or that for whatever reason the defendants have decided to no longer urge it, that we're back in front of the courts of the United States. And so dismissal having been for the purposes of form nonconvenience, that order being now defunct or non-pro-tunk or whatever it is, why would we have a gap then? If the fact is plaintiffs could not find a forum to have a meritorious ruling upon their claims, which are incredibly valid, then why would tolling have expired while they were out looking for that, because they were thrown out of the United States courts to go search for another forum? And the other argument was, well, they were on appeal during the parliament time. For the purposes of tolling is, and certainly of class certification, or I'm sorry, a filing of class action resulting in tolling, the purposes of that, you've been told, defendants, you've been told how many of us there are, potentially, and you've been told the nature of our claims. So you've been notified that we have claims against you and how many of us there are. And so that should result in tolling. And that should result in, just by the fairness of it, you've got a fair notice that we've got a claim to file. If we're on appeal or looking for a forum where we could have a meritorious trial on merits, why is it that the tolling would somehow have a gap or expiration date during that period of time? That doesn't make any sense. If we're back in the United States, whether it be 3 years later or 15 years later, now saying, look, we're back before you looking for trial on merits, whatever expired, as long as we've been pursuing our claims in the meantime, why is it unfair to the defendants that we've had to go searching here and there in order to get our gain in court? And that's what this is about. We have plaintiffs that have been wronged and have been waiting for justice for a very long time, up against very powerful defendants. And they've never sat on their rights. That's the phrase used in many of these cases that we've been discussing, that are in the briefs. That at the time you say tolling has expired and the statute of limitations has expired is when the plaintiffs sat around on their rights. And neither the plaintiffs nor Mr. Hinton have ever sat on their rights. This long journey that Mr. Brehm is talking about has been a long journey. They've become close. Because Mr. Hendler has never sat on his client's rights. And the record bears that out. I didn't see a light. I'm not sure if I'm
I think you still have a little bit of time. 2 minutes. If there's anything further.
The policy that American Pipe, Crown Cork and Seal, levy decision in the Ninth Circuit, the policy behind these cases is that class actions serve a purpose, not only fairness, but of economical and elegant dispensation of justice. Now, we should remember as we look at these length of this case, the journey that we've talked about, and the issues that are before the court, that the nature of class action evolved on these plaintiffs. It was in 1995 and 1997 that the Ortiz case and the Amchem case, the Supreme Court cases, basically found that the class actions weren't really the best way for personal injury plaintiffs with varying damages to file claims. The Amchem decision was the last of those two, I believe. You may have that backwards, but it came out in 1999. The one before that was 1997, just around the time this case was filed. The cause of action for you was filed. So class action litigation actually evolved during the pendency of this litigation to clarify that class actions maybe weren't the best way to pursue these claims. But that's how long ago this all began.
Actually, hasn't that changed?
Has it changed so that personal injury?
I mean, haven't there been some mass tort class actions since then?
I believe
9/11?
I believe it's evolving a little bit back to show that it's not a foregone conclusion that all personal injury claims are bearing damages.
Some of the airline disasters?
You're absolutely right. And it's evolving back and forth. My point, actually dovetailing with what you're saying there, is that we're looking for a trial on the merits for six individual claimants at this point. This is no longer a class action claim. These are not class representatives. We simply want a trial of six individuals, and these six individuals staked their claim to a right to this trial a long time ago, before any potential expiration of statute of limitations. And it's a simple thing. We're not asking here to win a case. We're asking for trial.
Anything further, Mr. Lyons? No. Thank you very much. Thank you to all of our attorneys here today. The court will take this matter under advisement.